Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Gilbert, whose latest novel is And Sons. That's ampersand Sons. Earlier novel is The Normals, and there's also a collection of short stories, Remote Feed. This novel has been getting some terrific reviews. It's the story of a writer in the vein, as you've said, of Salinger or Pynchon, though more Salinger, though the career continues.
With a little sprinkle of Roth, I think, Philip Roth.
Roth, if he'd written Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, exactly.
And wasn't Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, very waspy Roth.
Maybe Roth with a little Updike thrown in too.
Precisely. When I started, it was Updike Roth.
Let's start with that, because this is the story of a writer, and there are wheels within wheels, and it's kind of a Russian doll in a way. But let's start with the character of A.N. Dyer. When you were creating this book, which is about a week in his life and the life of his family and the relationship with his sons, what was the inspiration? I know that you were at some dinner or something, and you realized that you didn't really know your own father.
Yeah, I mean, my dad is this kind of a classic New York waspy guy of that generation, kind of came of age in the Eisenhower era, and he's kind of unknowable, and yet he's this impressive guy. And I remember when I was at this lunch, and he stood up to say a few words, and he's very good at public speaking, and he can do it, you know, off the cuff really easily. And I was sitting next to an old friend of his who turned to me and said, it just amazes me to see your dad do this and do this so well, because when he was a kid, he could barely look you in the eye. He had a stammer. He was an incredibly shy guy. And that didn't jive with the dad I knew, who was kind of this intimidating, aloof guy, never shy. So the idea of what if you could meet your dad when he was at his most vulnerable, when he was 17, how would your impressions change?
Did this happen around the time that you had finished The Normals? I mean, when did this event occur and you begin thinking about it?
Well, I'd finished The Normals, and that took much longer than I thought and was much more painful than I thought to write. And so I took some time off and did some screenplay stuff, which was just fun and enjoyable, because that was kind of like dessert after this full meal of trying to write a novel. I had a movie called Joshua. That's like a little genre movie about a creepy kid, and it did, we made it for like no money, yet we were able to get into Sundance and the Fox Searchlight. It was a great like little success story. The movie didn't do much business, but it was fun. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to write screenplays now for a while. And then I discovered that that was a fluke to get a movie made. It's incredibly impossible to get any movies made. So I had been thinking of this idea in the meantime, fathers and sons. I had just had a son in 2001, so it was definitely, scurrying around my feet nonstop. It seemed like a good topic to explore. And then when I came up with the idea of, well, maybe I should just make this unknowable father a writer, that started to get interesting to me as well, because then I thought I could do a whole career.
How did you decide on a Salinger-type beginning to this waspy Roth?
We're all fascinated by Salinger. We all wanted to know what he was doing for the last 35 years in New Hampshire. But I just wanted that Pynchon Salinger, someone who's not craving publicity, who shies away from it. I mean, Pynchon, I don't think, he goes about his life without actively being a recluse at all. I think he's a pretty social guy, actually. But yet he's gotten away with being, this mysterious figure. So I wanted the reclusiveness and the mystery to come about because of his relationship with his sons. And what if you had this father who, on one hand, had all these books in which you can open up the book and you could kind of experience your dad on the page and see his whole being, yet when you're in the same room with him, you couldn't string together three words?
Well, I suspect that's probably very true for a lot of children of famous people, whether they be politicians or writers.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, it's one thing. I mean, a writer isn't so much in the public sphere. They're so much in their head. It's difficult for children to have that experience of just kind of being present with the parent, because the parent might often be thinking about how to solve some sort of problem, because that's the real difficulty with writing, is that it's a 24/7 kind of job.
at this point, when you're thinking about that, then you start thinking about how many kids he has.
Yeah.
He has three sons, but mm-hmm. two adult sons.
Yeah.
When you're doing this, you still don't have an idea of the voice you have, or are you beginning to conceive of how you're going to structure the book?
Yeah, I have to come up with who the characters are, and I knew I wanted two adult sons who are relatively estranged from the dad. Then it's just trying to figure out, okay, what is the scenario that we see often with famous people, children of famous people? So one is kind of drug addiction, which you often see, and the other is kind of a flailing into the arts or attempting to go into the arts. So I kind of took those two spheres and created, you know, two sons out of that.
One of the sons is single. The other has kids, the character of Richard, and I kept getting the feeling that perhaps on some level that's the one, the character that you more identified with.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot more anger than I do, and he's got a lot more issues than I do. But he's kind of coming to grips with having kids and then having kids who are getting older, which is such a different relationship. When they're, you know, 3, 4, 5, up to 10, they're kind of, they're knowable. You understand who your kids are. But then when they start hitting adolescence, it's like you're locked out of the room and they start to become mysterious to you. I have an 11-year-old son, and he's starting to get into that age in which he wants to bump up against the adult world, as long as that adult world doesn't include me. You know, so it's been interesting.
Now we have the character of Philip Topping.
Mm-hmm.
And we have father and son there as well. How did all of that come about?
The book, I wanted to have lots of echoes, and so things are reflecting other things. So it is kind of a little bit of a hall of mirrors. So I wanted to have the one father and son relationship on one side with the Dyer family, and then the father and son relationship with the Topping family. And then to have Philip Topping be our kind of tour guide in this world. I don't know when that came up. I was intrigued by trying to pull it off. Like with the Zuckerman novels, with Roth, you know, he often does that, and I'm baffled by how he does that. I mean, I thought that both American Pastoral and The Human Stain were like, I was reading that in the mid-90s, and they had a huge influence on me. I just was so blown away by it that I wanted to see if I could try to pull that off to a degree. So that was a challenge I set up. And then also the kind of jazzy froth of a unreliable narrator. You know, it's kind of, those are fun. And to figure out what is fact and what is fiction. And if you're doing an unreliable narrator and it's a book about a fiction writer, then it kind of maybe spins it even more to make you say, well, who is writing who here at the end of the day?
In essence, David Gilbert, this is, from one perspective, a novel within a novel. Some of the sequences Philip is in, but most of the sequences, he's imagining what is in the heads of people that, as we learn toward the end of the book, I'm not giving that much away, he's never going to find out about.
Yeah.
He won't know what's happening in those scenes, and he's making it up.
Yeah, it's all fiction making. And at the end, I think you asked the question of who has really written this book. I mean, I think there's A.N. Dyer's influences in the book as well. Is he a potential author of the book? Is Philip the author of the book? Who is the writer of the book? Who is the teller of the tale? So I like when those things kind of shimmer. And I know it can also be frustrating. It's like, how does he know this stuff? He wasn't in the room. But that kind of opens up the question of fiction making, of how we do this stuff. In some ways, it's A.N. Dyer's book for his children. In some ways, that's what I often see it as.
David Gilbert, there's one other element here, which is that once you've decided on A.N. Dyer, you have to give him a career. Did the career come in piecemeal as you were writing the book, or did you figure out in advance what his career would be and its arc and the books that were in it?
I knew I wanted him to be a writer, and then I sat down, and I remember one of the first things I did was just make a little bibliography of all the books he'd written. And that was just a lot of fun to come up with titles, because titles are great. You know, there's nothing attached to a title except for the potential of what the title kind of portrays. So that was incredibly enjoyable. And then in the book itself, I do reproduce about 25 pages of Ampersand, which was a challenge because it is considered this great classic work of fiction. So you're setting yourself up for people to say, this is hardly a classic work of fiction. In the process of this book, he's reproducing that initial novel, retyping it out. You can see how he goes about doing it.
But it also means you have to go into, even though you're not writing the book, you have to take it seriously. You have to go in and once again figure out the voice of the book. You have to figure out the style of the book and how different that style will be from the style of the book and Sons.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully I did that all right. Yeah, that's a challenge, and that's also fun. The book also has little snippets of a lot of his other novels, and those were all incredibly enjoyable to write because it was like you're writing a novel without actually writing a novel. You can say this little paragraph represents a whole novel, and you're like, oh, I just wrote a whole novel in a paragraph.
You said in an interview that's kind of like Borges.
Exactly. It's what, I mean, Borges, whenever he felt like writing a novel, he would simply sit down and write a review of that novel, which is the greatest line ever. And you can tell when you read those stories, oh, yeah, that's what he was doing, essentially.
One element of the book is how people change through time. Another element is how fiction reflects nonfiction. And in this case, we have Ampersand reflecting the relationship of A.N. Dyer and Charles Topping, Philip's father.
Right.
And then on another level, we have the book itself on some level also representing your feelings about father. So it becomes this weird mirror thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get lost?
No, I had it pretty well figured out structure-wise. You know, every chapter is pretty much a certain kind of set scene. So you're getting from A to B. And then within that, I spin around in time a little bit, or a fair amount. But to have that through line of where I need the character to end up was incredibly helpful. And before I start, I had it not thoroughly outlined, but pretty well outlined.
Did any of the characters, they say that characters take over. Did that happen at all, or were you?
Not really. I mean, you know, there are little things, like there's a sequence in the book in which Andy, who's the youngest son of A.N. Dyer, goes with his newfound nephew, Emmett, to go get a pretzel in Central Park, which is something I did with an old friend of mine. We're trying to find the perfect hot dog. And so I kind of put that on to Andy and Emmett. And that sequence surprised me. I didn't think I would spend so much time on it. And then I got really into the idea that a pretzel looks a little bit like the ampersand, you know. And so you convince yourself you're on the right track. You're like, oh, yeah, because they're going for this pretzel because a pretzel looks like an ampersand. It also looks a little bit like DNA, you know. So, okay, I'm in the right track, even though it's, you know, suddenly it's a 15-page sequence of two boys trying to get a pretzel.
There's a lot of real places in the book, in Sons. J.G. Mellon, that's a real restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kind of this hamburger joint on 74th and 3rd, which hasn't changed in 30 years, and is very, it's kind of like one of those old preppy establishments on the Upper East Side.
A lot of the sequences take place in the Dyer apartment, which is across the street from the Frick.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real building, of course.
Yeah.
Do you know apartments in it?
I don't. I grew up in New York. My mother grew up in New York, and she seems to have been in every single apartment building in all of the city. So she always, I was like, what are those apartments like in there? And she's like, oh, they're great. They're these great duplexes that look out over the park and the Frick. It's like, okay, that will work for the book.
Did you go to a prep school?
I did. I went to St. George's School. I did not go to Exeter. I was not bright enough to go to Exeter. But my wife did, and she's very upset that I stole her high school for the book. But Exeter's kind of that uber prep school. It's kind of the prep school that exists in our imagination when we close our eyes and think of a prep school. And also a separate piece I kind of wanted to use. It's already been used in fiction, so I thought, okay, it's fair game.
In an interview, you talked about how you were always interested in how we travel through time and age and change. Where does that interest come from, you think?
I think what I'm really interested in is how we travel through time, yet we carry who we are throughout that travel. So I'm as much of a 17-year-old as I am a 46-year-old, as I am a 32-year-old. I mean, I'm not a big believer that you necessarily learn things. You just maybe, you get a level of experience in which you know what not to do and what to do. I'm 46 and I can't believe I'm 46. You know, it's just a shocking development. And everyone feels the same way. And so it definitely wanted to, you know, explore that.
There's one point where the character of Isabel, her character, looks in the mirror and then looks away and says, the only way I know that I'm old is if I look in a mirror,
yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah.
I'm the same person.
Yeah.
But obviously she's not, and you're not the same, and I'm not the same.
Mm-hmm. But also, there are plenty of 46-year-olds who make a series of incredibly asinine decisions that only an 18-year-old would make. So, you know, you think you're accruing kind of a certain kind of worldly, you know, intelligence, but then you will the next day totally disappoint yourself and reveal that you actually are as much a 17-year-old as you are.
When did you realize that there wasn't going to be a magic moment when you suddenly became an adult?
I'm still trying to wait for that magic moment. I mean, having kids certainly is a big aspect of it. That's when you get out of your own head, especially as a writer. And I really enjoy being a father, you know, my favorite thing. So being able to kind of dip into those present waters when you're with your children is such a, you know, not only a relief, but is a gift. You know, taking care of these, I have three kids, is, you know, does make me feel like an adult. But then the second they're away, I'm like, God, if only they knew. Children having children, essentially.
Isabel, she's A.N. Dyer's former wife.
Yeah, former wife.
Is the only female character with a point of view in the
mm-hmm.
book.
Yeah.
How deliberate was that?
It was pretty deliberate. I mean, I knew I wanted this to be about fathers and sons, but then I knew I wanted to have a moment in which we get some female perspective. So I knew that there was going to be a section devoted to her, and I worked incredibly hard on that section to try to make it, to give her point of view a certain kind of integrity and honesty. With Isabel, it was just an attempt to do justice to her and to put a little bit of roundness to these men, to give what the mother and wife point of view is, because particularly men of my father's generation, you know, that the women did so much of the social care of these fathers and husbands. They created the dinner parties or going out to dinner, you know, the friendships, really. And so I wanted to show that these men are, in many cases, still boys dealing with their mothers. And these poor wives find themselves more often than not in the position of being mothers.
There's a long set sequence at the Frick Museum. Have you been to any literary parties at the Frick?
Never. Uh-uh. I did hear of a book party at the Metropolitan Museum at the Temple of Dendor, which is pretty amazing. No, I just wanted to do kind of an over-the-top scene, and it is a big, kind of juicy set piece where all the characters find themselves coming together to honor this younger writer who is kind of an echo of A.N. Dyer in some way.
And you saw it from multiple perspectives. I mean, this is like a 40-page scene. Did
yeah.
you expect it to be that big?
Not really. But then I decided it would be interesting to enter that environment three different ways through three different characters, experiencing three different emotions. So that became interesting to me to try to pull that off.
And the character of Eric Hark,
uh-huh.
based on anyone?
No, not really. I mean, he has this love of architecture. So I was kind of thinking of, you know, Brad Pitt has a little bit of a love of architecture. I borrowed a little bit of that. And he has kind of that, you know, Brad Pitt when he was in his 20s. I want him to be smart, you know, and not just some sort of shallow character. I mean, he has his passions, and he's no dummy.
It seemed to me that if there were any scene that you had more fun with, it would be the last part of that when A.N. Dyer walks into
yeah.
the... Is that right?
Well, that was really fun to write. And then there's a sequence at the Metropolitan Museum of Art where Andy is, he's been called up by this woman he's having this little flirty relationship with. And she says to him, if you can find me the next hour and a half in front of my favorite work of art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you can have me, essentially. So he then gets up and rushes into the museum and is running around trying to imagine what artwork she might be standing in front of. And that was a lot of fun to write.
David Gilbert, you grew up in this upper class. What does your father do?
He was an investment banker. Back before investment bankers became kind of the what you imagine investment bankers to be. I mean, he worked at Morgan Stanley for 30 years. It was kind of before the world of finance really got out of control. In school, my dad's profession as a banker was, there were lawyers, doctors. It was that kind of certainly upper middle class existence on the Upper East Side of New York.
Republican?
My dad? Kind of like a Rockefeller Republican, I would say. Not terribly conservative. And probably with the current Republican Party would be seen as a, you know, flat-out liberal.
What happened with you? How did you become a writer?
My mother's side of the family, her brothers worked at Newsweek. My grandfather was a writer for Time for a long time. His name is Douglas Auchincloss. He wrote the religion column for Time, and this was back in the 50s or something like that.
Auchincloss?
Uh-huh. And Louis Auchincloss, it was his, I think, cousin. I knew Louis just a tiny, tiny bit. I met him a couple of times, and he was a character. You know, the writing thing, I don't know where it came from, because neither my brother or sister are interested in writing. My sister a little bit. I was dyslexic growing up, so what everyone told me that I couldn't do was write. They wanted me to steer clear of that kind of profession. Not that even was talking about profession, but just writing came hard, just the mechanics of it. A lot of it was stubbornness. It was kind of like, I'm going to show you I can write.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, which was great, and they have a wonderful writing program there. So I did a lot of my, you know, kind of early education in writing came from Middlebury.
Were you writing short stories?
Writing a lot of short stories. At Middlebury, you could major in English, and then within that major, you could be focused on creative writing, so it was great. So I graduated with, you know, a 150-page beginning of a novel that I don't think anyone will ever see. But it taught me that, okay, I can do this, and I enjoy doing it. And so from there, I went to grad school at the University of Montana in Missoula.
You were studying writing there?
Mm-hmm. Studying writing there. I graduated from there in 95, loved living in Missoula. Came back to New York with, you know, kind of your classic MFA briefcase full of 10 short stories. And I got very, very lucky and quickly, I have like practically the slush pile, placed a story in Harper's Magazine. From there, got an agent, and then a month later got a story in The New Yorker. So it was like a very frothy, you know, 6 weeks that I've is yet to be repeated in my life. And so then I had the classic kind of two-book deal in which, okay, you have short stories, and I had this idea for a novel. That was the normals. And I thought, okay, I can write a short story in about, you know, I was a pretty fast writer. I could write a short story in 2 weeks, and it was pretty well finished. So I thought, okay, a novel, that will take how many short stories? You know, that will take me maybe a year and a half. So, you know, the contract was, you know, deliver the manuscript in a year and a half. In the course of that year and a half, basically the only thing I could write were letters to my editor saying, please, for the love of God, release me from this contract, because it was just so hard for me to do. And the later I then got with the delivery of this manuscript, the crazier I got, to the point where I was no longer writing sentence by sentence. I was writing to fit the sentences within the page so that they looked perfect. Because if I was going to deliver something late, not only did the writing have to be perfect, but it had to actually look perfect on the page. I mean, it was madness.
And what happened? You sent it in?
Medication helped. Because basically it was OCD that right. I was going through. And a lot of it, too, is kind of classic. I was seeing a woman, my girlfriend, who's now my wife. But it was a great excuse to put life off, you know, to not grow up, to say, when I finish the novel, that's when we're going to get married.
Were you living on a trust fund or something at the time?
Trust fund? I mean, I definitely am fortunate in having some money so that I can do full-time writing and a little bit of teaching. So trying to finish the normals, and finally life caught up with me and got married and had a child. And then I was like, okay, I just got to finish this book. I can't, you know, it's time to get it done. And so it was about a year and a half after that I finished it.
And then the normals came out, and did you go to Hollywood, or did you stay in New York and just send screenplays?
So after the normals, I had no desire to write another novel. I luckily met a friend of my wife's husband, and he was a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker, and he had the rights to End Zone, Don DeLillo's second novel about football, and he said, would you ever be interested in adapting that screenplay with me? I was like, this is perfect. Yes, because I do not want to try to write another novel. So we started to work on the screenplay, And that was a lot of fun, too, to have kind of that collaboration and to, you know, actually be in the room with someone and have someone to have lunch with. I mean, that becomes a very important thing.
Did you meet DeLillo?
I did meet DeLillo. So we wrote the screenplay, and it kind of – it traveled up the food chain, and a lot of people loved it. But then, you know, the final person would always say no because it was about football, and that doesn't translate well to overseas markets. And because it was about football, it also was more expensive than anyone, you know, had a taste for because of all the crowd scenes and silly football stunts. DeLillo really liked the script, and so he called us up and said, I want to take you guys out to lunch. It was right before the beginning of the Iraq War because I had my old copy of End Zone, which he signed, and he signed it like on the eve of the war. And that was all worth it just for that because I'm a huge DeLillo fan, and he was just couldn't be a nicer guy. So we had done this movie that was just a little too expensive, or maybe a lot too expensive. So we decided, and we really liked working together, that we had to do something that was cheap and more genre-related. So Joshua was, you know, is this kind of creepy kid story, kind of the bad seed on the Upper East Side. We wrote that in about 3 months. In 3 months, we had financing. 3 months, we were shooting it. And in 3 months, we were in Sundance at the film festival. It was like this crazy moment in which it all happened in less than a year. And so I thought, oh, wow, okay, the movie business is great. I'm going to do this now. And so I wrote a bunch of screenplays, and they got optioned and whatnot, but they never have yet to see the light of day. And
you can make a good living writing screenplays that get optioned and never get made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was always looking for it because I'm good at it, and if anyone out there is listening and has a script that needs to be rewritten, I'm very good at rewriting things. I wanted that job. I wanted the 3 weeks, $100,000 rewrite a script, me and everyone else.
So now we come to End Sons. I mean, you said you'd never wanted to write a novel.
Again, after The Normals? What happened is you write these screenplays, and I really liked the screenplays that I wrote. I mean, I thought they were pretty good stories, and people liked them, but once again, the final person who can say yes never was willing to say yes. So at the end of the day, it was like, okay, I want to write something that only belongs to me. It's my creation. And then I had this idea that was kind of rich enough and big enough and interesting enough to say, okay, I can spend the next, you know, 5 years working on this.
You know, as I'm hearing you talk, I'm thinking, you know, now I'm beginning to understand the scene in the Frick Museum because it plays like a scene from a screenplay. You
mm-hmm.
can just see it on the screen. It's like, on some level, a lot of And Sons, but that scene in particular, as well as the funeral at the beginning,
yeah.
It's a film scene in your head.
Yeah, I'm a pretty visual writer that way, and I'm certainly incredibly influenced by movies. I mean, you know, I've probably seen more movies than I've read books, you know, to be honest. So movies are certainly, you know, a huge influence on me.
When it comes to themes, you know, I've talked to writers about this. I know we've talked about a little bit about mm-hmm. some of the themes in this book. How much do you think about themes when you're writing?
A lot. I think that's the interesting stuff. I mean, obviously you don't want your theme to be hitting you over the head, you know, as you're reading it. But to try to think of all the ways that you can express that theme, whatever that theme might be, in either little secret corners of the book that only you know about, but you know that you've done the work to express it, and it's there, and it's satisfying, and in ways that are a little bit more obvious and kind of make for a richer reading experience. I mean, that's what I enjoy in a good book, is to feel like, okay, I can start to dissect it and see, oh, this is all relating to each other in some way.
So pretty much for you, a lot of the subtexts are always conscious.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly when you do the work of rewriting it and you can start to see, oh, there's that little piece of gold right there. Let's see if I can bring it to the surface a little bit more. I mean, when I started this book, I had a post-it note that I wrote reproduction on and just kind of put it over my desk because I just wanted that idea of all the ways we reproduce things.
And so that's, in a sense, what Dyer is doing.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing that. I mean, we all kind of do that to overtly and just in terms of subconsciously as well.
You did say in an interview, much of the book is about how we make fiction of our lives. I wanted to give the narrator an opportunity to actively make his own fiction from the story of the Dyers. That, then, was absolutely conscious from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted that first-person voice that also kind of dips into the third person. You know, I wanted to try to pull that off.
How do you feel you did?
I mean, I think I pulled it off. I think it doesn't hamper your reading experience. I think sometimes Philip Topping, the character, is probably the most unlikable character in the book, so he can get in the way of things. But I liked him as someone who has his nose pressed up against the glass, that is the Dyer family, and desperate to be part of that. I like that setup. It's sometimes I think maybe I could have quieted him down a little bit, but I think in terms of the overall reading experience, it all flows pretty well. I think if you're a reader who gets upset with the idea of how can that person possibly know that, it's impossible, he wasn't there, didn't hear that conversation, then you might find him to be pretty frustrating.
There's a key sequence, and Richard, the son, says, "Get out of here."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He even says it, too, overtly to the reader. You know, he addresses them and say, "Am I in your way? You know, I know that the Dyers are more interesting."
So you knew all along that this could become problematic.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And I was hoping that, you know, other people would tell me if he was becoming problematic. And for the most part, I mean, he probably got cut down a little bit in some of the edits, but, you know, he pretty much remained the same.
The title and sons, you needed to have the ampersand, I guess.
Yeah. Growing up in New York, you see these buildings in which you can see kind of the ghostly image of the sign that was there 40 years ago. And I remember passing a few of them that you'd always just see the and sons without really seeing
the name
yeah. above it. And that was intriguing to me, just to see, like, who were these sons and what was the business and things like that. And then the ampersand is basically a reflection of this incredible egoist that is A.N. Dyer. His initials are A, and I mean, his book is essentially his first big book, Ampersand, is you know, him, essentially.
Did the title Ampersand come from figuring out the title of And Sons?
Yeah. I mean, I liked And Sons as a title. I always start off with titles, you know. I mean, I have the idea for the book, but then I have to come up with the title pretty early on. I decided, let's put the ampersand in there and let's call the book Ampersand, and then the book within the book. And then there are letters in these books that reveal kind of the reason why perhaps he used the title Ampersand for his novel. So it all kind of starts to shake out a little bit.
Those letters are handwritten and reproduced. You wrote those?
I did not. I wish I had such good handwriting. The interior designer for Random House did it, and he wrote all the letters from Charlie. No, he wrote the A.N. Dyer letters, and then he had a friend of his who was a woman write the letter from Charlie to A.N. Dyer.
Towards the end, yeah.
But when I saw those letters, I was just blown away because I just thought, I assumed that they would just use one of those kind of crappy fonts that replicate handwriting, which I had done in my own, you know, in writing this book. But when they showed me what they were, you know, had come up with, I was just blown away because I really wanted, and that was the other reason why, like, there are lots of very real places like J.G. Mellon or the Frick. I wanted it to be a real concrete place, like a sense of place.
David Gilbert, now that you've finished this book, what are you working on now?
I have no idea. The fun part about writing is thinking about writing, and the hard part about writing is actually writing. So I'm in that fun part of thinking about what I'm going to write next. So I'm kind of pulling together a bunch of different ideas and trying to slam them into a possible novel. And then I'll probably start writing it in the new year. You know, I'll spend 3 or 4 months thinking about it and then see how it goes.
And do you plan to go back to screenwriting, or for the moment is that
it? Yeah, no, because I love screenwriting. I think it's fun. It's a lot of white space, so it's not much actual writing, which is the best part. You know, you get your final draft and you open it up, and suddenly you're on page 7, it seems. There's so much white space. And it's like dessert. And I think I have that kind of visual sensibility that translates decently to screenwriting.
You've been listening to an interview with David Gilbert, whose latest novel is And Sons. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.